Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, coming to you today from the RCA Exhibition Hall in Radio City, where today's guest is Gerald F. Winfield, author of a new book, which is timed for today's headlines. The title, China, the Land and the People. But before Dr. Winfield meets his critics face to face, here's the man who keeps the peace on these programs, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. For 13 years, from 1932 to 1945, Dr. Gerald F. Winfield lived and worked with the Chinese people. He not only learned their language fluently, but also the depth and range of their problems in farming, in industry, and above all, in public health. By profession a research biologist, Dr. Winfield served during the war in China as director of the United Nations Picture News Office. He is now director of United Service to China here in New York. Here now, with a brief account of the theme and highlights of his book, China, the Land and the People, is our author of the afternoon, scientist and public health expert, Dr. Gerald Winfield.
China, the Land and the People is an attempt to draw in broad outline the picture of China as she is, and to sketch some of the important problems and processes involved in her rebuilding. It is primarily concerned with the struggle to harness the Chinese environment with modern methods, and only secondarily considers the implications of the political struggle. In the first half of the book, there's an attempt to present a reasonably complete and accurate picture of the fundamental aspects of Chinese life as it exists today. After a brief look at the geographical stage and the human actors, there are chapters that present agriculture, diet, clothing, and shelter, commerce, industry and transportation, health, education, language, local government, and some of the effects of the past decade of war on these various aspects of the immense, fascinating organism that is China. Building on this background, the second half of the book goes on to try to trace, from the point of view of a biologist and public health worker, the interrelated problems that must be solved if China is to shift from her present unsatisfactory position into a type of life that is modern and capable of bringing more good to a greater portion of the people. Starting with my own work in village sanitation, the book considers the problems of agriculture, industry, population control, and education. The last chapter looks at politics. This book is written with the profound conviction that to be well informed, Americans need to know much more the depth and complexity of the problems that confront our civilization as it attempts to build a better life for the whole of the human family. I try hard to present these problems in their stark reality. At the same time, I have deep faith that real progress can be made toward their solution.
Thank you, Dr. Winfield. Now let's have a sample of how our critics feel. First, a veteran reporter on Chinese affairs and co-author of the best-selling Thunder Out of China, Anna Lee Jacoby.
The title of the book is China, the Land and the People, as Dr. Winfield said. Unfortunately, he also discusses politics. And since he is a scientist, a public health expert, and a good one, unfortunately, he is not also a political expert. And his discussion of this kind of thing is filled with a sort of foggy optimism, which I think is largely responsible for the tragedy of China for the last 3 years.
Thank you, Ms. Jacoby. And now, with a totally different point of view, former American advisor to the Chinese government, just returned from Nanking, Harold Lord Varney.
I like China, the Land and the People, because it is one of the few recent books on China which doesn't start out to preach a sermon. Most American books on China start out with an ideological bias, then they select the facts about China which seem to prove their thesis. Dr. Winfield, as an author, is refreshingly different. He has let the facts speak for themselves. He has maintained a fair objectivity throughout his chapters. Also, he avoids the pitfall of most China authors, which is oversimplification. He recognizes the vast complexity of the China problem, and he makes it clear that there are no quack and one-shot answers. His emphasis is on fundamental rather than demagogic solutions for China's difficulties. This is a book which the American people have long needed. It'll do much to clear away the fog banks.
Thank you, Dr. Varney. Now, Disagreement here is plain, but before our critics come to grips with Dr. Winfield, here is your announcer with a special message.
For several weeks, the Author Meets the Critics has been campaigning for new books for disabled veterans. Today, we'd like to speak of a very special group of these men in Northport Hospital, the group of the emotionally disturbed. Perhaps even more than physically handicapped men, the emotionally ill need the help that comes from new ideas, from the turning of their thoughts away from themselves and the endless circle of private inner worries. What they need is a fresh breeze to blow through the smothering fog of anxiety. This breeze can often be whipped up by a new book. But what kind of book should it be? This is the real challenge to the librarian of Northport Hospital. It's up to the librarian and her assistants to find in each patient the special interest often hidden, which will prompt him to read, to lose himself happily in the pages of a book. Taste varies among these veterans as much as it varies everywhere outside hospital walls. Some men have vocational interests carried over from before the war. A farmer or a mechanic will find not only a distraction, but a real boost to morale and health in technical books on the jobs which they plan to take up again. Others of old hobbies, motorboats, stamp collecting, photography, and books on these subjects help to restore their joy in life. But almost all the veterans of World War II like to keep up with current fiction. If you've just found a new book which roused your own interest, why not send it to the veterans at Northport Hospital, Northport, Long Island, New York. Now, back to John McCaffrey.
Well, now, Mrs. Jacoby, where do you object to Dr. Winfield's politics or the naivete of his political ideas?
Well, Mr. Varney said, I think very optimistically, that Dr. Winfield talked about facts and presented only the salient facts, also that he was not foggy, that he cleared away the fog. I think this is just so untrue. In his discussion of education, for instance, Dr. Winfield says that isolation and inflation were responsible for all the hardships of the Chinese students. As a matter of fact, more than half the students in most of the universities were people going through free on scholarships given by the Chinese government, and their first duty was to spy. Professors had to pass them in examinations because if they didn't, the professor would be held politically suspect. These students did more to drag down the level of education in China. All throughout, the difficulties of the Chinese government are underplayed. Censorship, concentration camps, secret police are mentioned just in passing. Really, they had more to do with China's hardships more recently than anything else. He hardly notices them.
Did you notice them, Mr. Varney?
I confess that I got a different view of the book from my reading, from Mrs. Jacoby's view. I felt that Dr. Winfield laid a very excellent foundation for his approach to politics in the part of his book in which he discussed the fundamental problems of China. After all, China has fundamental problems which precede the political problems. And his discussion of the political problem in the final chapter, it seemed to me, was very aptly done. The note of optimism, which Mrs. Jacoby mentioned, it seemed to me, is not a characteristic of the book.
Oh, but Mr. Varney, how can he talk about the difficulties of China for all those chapters excellently as he did, and clearly as he did, and then say anything like this? The prospects are good provided the country does not become communist or break up into a number of more or less independent sections. Isn't it doing just that?
It is about the present time. Events are moving very rapidly in China. A book which was written 6 months or a year ago naturally couldn't forecast some of the events of China. Dr. Winfield was writing from the premises of the period in which he wrote the book.
Well, I think any man who sets himself up as an expert should have been able to tell 6 months to a year ago that just what is happening would have happened.
I think there was a great confusion, not only in China, but in the world at large, and certainly here in America, in regard to what was to happen in China. And I certainly
would. Confusion, yes. I think confusion increased by just this kind of optimistic outline, which only served to fog the problem.
The optimism which appears in the book is an optimism of purpose, rather than an optimism of a categorical statement.
Oh, yes.
Well, if Dr. Winfield's book was written sometime before current events in China, I have some remarks of Mrs. Jacoby which should be fairly up to date since they appear in today's New York Times Book Review in her review of Claire Chennault's book Way of a Fighter. And Mrs. Jacoby says this, that Chennault fails to realize that China's war represents not aggression, as he calls it, but a revolt of the Chinese people against an intolerable way of life. That this revolution cannot be contained at the Yangtze or anywhere else, this side of increased freedom and improved living standards. This fact is basic, as the communists will discover, too. Well, Mrs. Jacoby, isn't that disregarding the fact that China's war has been waged between the nationalist governments and some people who are communists, that is, who are people serving a foreign power? This isn't quite a self-contained revolution, is it?
Oh, no. But Mr. Winfield says that the people object to communist aims and communist methods. And it seems very clear to me in China that the people are preferring communist aims and methods to the government, which is even worse. Although we may find it difficult here to believe that. China's war, it's true, is for a better life. Mr. Winfield explains during most of his book why they need a better life. But then, during the last chapter, he goes on to say that communists will probably never come to power, that the people aren't really for them. Why, nonsense. It's the people of China who've been voting in a way for the communists. And that shows how bad their straits have been.
I think that you'll have to define people, Mr. Jacoby. After all, revolutions, even the most popular revolutions, are always accomplished by small minorities of the population. And in China,
I don't think
Yes, always.
You have a quarter of a million soldiers surrounded by a lesser number than that in Manchuria who either surrendered, stopped fighting, or went over to the enemy with all their guns. You have peasants who've been feeding those communist armies, peasants who've been rebelling against the government armies. This doesn't mean that the people are communists. It means that by helping Chiang Kai-shek during the last 4 years, we've cut out any middle way, and we've made people choose between two armies, not among three or more political ideologies.
Well, the question of whether we are helping Chiang Kai-shek is a different question, but the question of whether the communist revolution represents a majority or even a considerable percentage of the Chinese population, I think, is a moot question. The communist revolution is a revolution which a militant minority have very cleverly and very brilliantly achieved through demagogic methods, which are the very antithesis of what Dr. Winfield is suggesting in his book. Why I like Dr. Winfield's book is because he has shown that there is another alternative in China to the empty demagogism which the communists have offered as their program to the people in winning and courting popularity.
The same kind of program that Chiang Kai-shek offered when he, too, conquered China with a militant minority, and the same kind of program which has been on his books for 15 years but never implemented, with laws which read very well for Western ears but which have never been enforced.
Mr. Jacoby, I think that you should give Chiang Kai-shek the benefit of the doubt by mentioning the fact that For 11 years now, China has been in a condition of continuous war, 8 years with the Japanese and 3 years during the Civil War, which is still in progress.
Yes.
Now, I don't see how any fundamental economic or agrarian program could be accomplished by a country which is torn and ravaged by the type of warfare that China has suffered from.
Mr. Varney, don't underestimate your opposition. The communists have been at war, too, with Zhang on one side and Japanese on the other, and they did improve land processes. They did decrease the literacy rate in the army and among the people. They did do the very kind of thing which helped the things that the people need. The government didn't do any of those things. The communists succeeded in doing it. And all that time, Chiang Kai-shek, because people here in the United States were saying he's a Christian, he's a Democrat, were persisting in sending help to him, and he meanwhile was putting all the liberal, middle-of-the-road people in jail. He was exiling the Democratic League members. He was making it absolutely impossible to set up a fair representative coalition government, and he made it inevitable for the people to have anything but communism. There wasn't anything else for them to turn to.
Mr. Varney and Mr. Jacoby, I don't think that we can contain our author anymore, and so now I'm going to give you your turn at last, Dr. Winfield.
Well, this whole business of whether or not, in the first place, I don't think that it's factually true that anywhere in the book I said communism wasn't going to take power in China. I think that I did foresee many of the things that are now happening as real possibilities, but I'm still willing to say that the communists are not the solution to the problem, and that we may have now in China to go through still another period, or two or three periods of swing around, before these processes of rebuilding that I've been trying to describe really get underway. Also, I'd like to point out that while the communist land program, as a program, has a good many political advantages, and it is a very definite means of moving toward the control of the political situation in China, and they have used it as such, that it's not at all sure that it is a step in the right direction toward really solving the problems of China.
Oh, I agree with that. I think that Dr. Winfield's outline of the land program problem and his whole 50-year plan for the rehabilitation of China is excellent and fine. I recommend that everybody read it. It's the best thing I've seen of its kind.
But you see, the thing is that we're moving into a situation where the Chinese people, well, then what about the Chinese people? What about the 50 30 to 50 million of them who've been on the roads as refugees away from the communists. What about all the friends that I know of who, and they're not all just people who work for the central government either, or are they all educated folk who have moved off of their farms because they own a slightly larger farm, or they were afraid of being impressed into the communist army and fled to the cities? What about the 2 million refugees in Shanghai now who are largely out of Shandong in their efforts to get away from this great, wonderful thing that the communists represent?
And what about the poor refugees who are driven out of their homes and see their homes burned by the nationalist armies who make them leave so as to scorch the earth before the communists come in? People who would much rather stay put.
Well, there's been that in a few places, I'll admit. But I think that the great mass of the voluntary leaving and moving out to somewhere else have been by people in China who have been trying to get away from the communists, not away from the central government.
They can get away from the communists. It's practically impossible to get away from the central government. There you have to have a passport to leave the city. And there are roadblocks set up by police outside every city. You have an internal visa system which absolutely prevents movement. It stopped all the third-party politicians from organizing or having conferences during the war. Really, you can't be a refugee from the central government. It takes the greatest of skill. There's an underground, which might be compared to our Civil War underground.
That's true.
You just can't do it.
Perhaps. I'm not even willing to admit that it's as bad as you outline it. But I'm talking about the villagers, these common people that are supposed to be the ones that the communists are primarily interested in.
Well, now, Dr. Winfield and Miss Jacoby, I haven't been to China, unlike everyone else here. I'm just an average American who is quite puzzled. And your discussion has amply demonstrated to me some of the complexities of the Chinese problem. But I'm wondering, what are we going to do? Chiang has fallen as the head of the government. It seems inevitable that communism will take over China. And here you tell us, in your last chapter on the challenge of China, Dr. Winfield, that a fourth objective of America's policy must be the development of ways in which her immense wealth can be put to work within the framework of capitalism for the rapid expansion of benefits to the Chinese people. And a further objective must be to foster a truly democratic revolution as the social and political dynamic for the rebuilding of China's life. It seems to me that, faced with a communist China, that neither of those things are even remote possibilities as far as our attitude toward China are concerned.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey, they're not. That within the capitalist framework, I think, is a wishful thinking phrase. China never had a capitalist framework. As a matter of fact, now Chiang Kai-shek's government is more socialist than the socialist government of England by far. More socialist probably than the communists intend to be.
One of the reasons why it's fallen in a lot of places.
Yes. Well, Dr. Winfield points that out, I think, in that final chapter.
He does indeed. Well, but then how can he say within a capitalist framework there never has been any such thing?
Oh, yes. There's a fundamental capitalist framework. But what I mean by that phrase in that particular passage is not capitalist framework within China, but a capitalist framework within the world. I think we're going to see. We may not. Our problem now is how are we going to deal with the situation in China in the interregnum between the time when we have to let the communists go ahead and try to struggle with the solution of China's problems, and the time when we, as Westerners who are not interested in the promotion of communism, get an opportunity to re-enter the situation. Now, don't kid yourself. The communists are not going to succeed in taking over and building up and operating China any more readily than Jiang did. Now, they have some things that are in their favor that Jiang didn't have. Some of their social and political ideas do have viability.
Well, you indicate in your own chapter, Dr. Winfield, that some of those things are working, such as the redistribution of land and the new handling of rents and taxes on income, for instance.
Yeah. On the other hand, their biggest problem is going to come right at this point of capital.
Yes, that's true.
The capitalization of a plant really begin to solve their problem.
You say that
they're going to open some doors themselves if they stay in power and if they really begin to try to move toward a solution of raising the standard of living problem for the Chinese people.
They're going to meet tremendous problems. But you say, Dr. Winfield, that they haven't the experts. They don't have the technicians that Chiang Kai-shek has. Now, look at how the capture of Beijing is coming about. All the experts are sitting still. There's going to be a peaceful occupation of that city. And the communists are going to walk in with a running city. All the utilities are going to be operating. All the experts are going to be at their desks. All the technicians are going to be working. Don't you think they might do that throughout China? The technicians will go over.
But that's still only a drop in the bucket of what they've got to have.
Yes.
What they've got to have beyond that is where the rub comes in, and it's not so much experts as it's steel and machinery.
Yes.
It's the...
And capital.
It's the whole business of a capital plant. Remember that in the second half of my book, when I calculate that in order to raise the standard of living of the Chinese people to where they have only the average of $130 per person per year, American money income, for the whole population, they've got to build up a plant which is large as America had in 2629. Now, that's a capital plant with $120 billion U.S. dollars worth of capital goods tied up in it.
Are they going to be able to do that if the United States lets down our own iron curtain and refuses to trade with a communist China, which we may do?
Well, I think maybe we ought to. That's one of the possibilities that lie before us, that we've got to see whether or not the communists are able to swing this deal as one of the ways by which, in a capitalist framework, we re-enter the situation for the good of the Chinese people.
But now, Dr. Winfield,
don't you think, Mrs. Jacoby, that it's very important in determining whether the United States will help and trade with a communist-ruled China, how the communists conduct themselves?
Oh,
in other words, if the communists make as the prerequisite of their continued power that they're going to introduce a policy of punishing political criminals, it seems to me that they make it very difficult for us to bring about the collaboration.
Well, they've had an example for a long time. Chiang Kai-shek has called them bandits for a low these 8 years and have talked about suppressing them and stamping them out by force. I can't say that I approve of either. I must say, though, that we might experiment with China. I'm not sure what will happen myself. If we cut off China from all of our exports, which needs so badly, won't it have to turn to Soviet Russia? And won't we be then helping to make it independent finally? No matter what hardships it has to go through first, won't it hate us if we refuse to give it what it needs? And if we do deal with it now, mightn't it stay a little bit independent because the Chinese communists, as you know, don't have any love for Moscow?
Well, I'm not so sure about how much love they have for Moscow or not. I haven't been with them, or you perhaps know more about that through some of your contacts and relationships than I do.
They're Marxists, goodness knows. But
well, I know, Mr. Jacoby, that years ago on this very program, Agnes Medley sat here and told us from her book, Battle Hymn of China, communists are not communists, they're just Jeffersonian Democrats.
Nonsense.
That was the line in those days. Now you're telling me that the communists in China have no love for Moscow. Well, that sounds suspiciously to me like telling me that they're Jeffersonian Democrats.
I think there's no relation. Anyone who ever said they were Jeffersonian Democrats was trying to conceal the situation. Why, they're out-and-out Marxists. Always have been. They've never tried to conceal it themselves.
Well, but perhaps we were just naive. We didn't know that Thomas Jefferson was a Marxist. That's where the whole difficulty comes in.
But this fact is true. They believe heart and soul that with the same ideology as Moscow. Still, though, their first families were killed by Chiang Kai-shek. Every communist leader has a new set of children and a second wife because the first were killed by Chiang in the Shanghai slaughter when he turned against them. They used to be a single party, you know, and they were killed almost within a week. And during that time, Russia did nothing to help them, wouldn't even give them shelter in the embassy. And then after that, Russia, as you know, sent a whole fighter group to Chiang Kai-shek with pilots. And sent Chiang bullets and equipment. Yes, but a great many of those goods were, of course, turned on the communists.
And
400 million people, it's a little bit hard to swallow up 400 million people completely. That may happen, but I think that our cutting China off may speed it.
I can't agree with Mr. Jacoby that no help was given by the Russians to the Chinese during the 1926-1927 period of the First Civil War, because at that time, a raid which was made on the Soviet embassy in Beijing brought to light an enormous amount of documents, the record of which is now in the archives of the Chinese government, proving that direct financial aid was given through Borodin to the Chinese communists.
And
the foundation of the party was achieved through Russian money.
You say to the communists, but at that time the communists and the Kuomintang were a single party. I mean, when the slaughter began, not a life was saved by the Russians. The communists saw themselves tracked down like animals and their families killed. Russia did nothing to help them.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Jacoby and gentlemen. It's time for your summations. I'm going to ask each one of you to make a closing statement, 1 minute without interruption. And while you're planning what to say, here's a special announcement.
Northport Hospital is about 2,800 disabled veterans, men for whom the most cruel, chaotic war in history has proved a serious shock. These men need something to hook onto in order to recapture their emotional health, in order to feel whole again. One of the ways to rouse their interest and help take them out of themselves is through books. The men who are not confined to bed can go to the library themselves in a supervised group. Some make straight for the shelves, the musician to pick out a biography of a pianist, the boxer to look for books on the ring. But there are others who stand in the room helplessly, gazing out the window, lost, indifferent. It's up to the librarian to discover what they used to be interested in and rekindle the spark. For the librarian knows that a real live interest is a signpost pointing the way to help. For the men in bed, book trucks are wheeled through, and again the librarian has to meet the challenge of what books to select for the trucks. The special requests are easy. For instance, she knows that the former bareback rider, blinded in the war, wants to have Variety magazine read to him for news of his friends. But for the men who sit still and remote and show no special interest, she must have a general assortment of books on the truck out of which she may be able to find the one particular book to unlock the door to a man's mind. If some new book has just helped you to forget your troubles, remember that it might be just what some troubled veteran needs right now. Address it to Northport Hospital, Northport, Long Island, New York.
All right, and now to you, Mr. Varney, for your one-minute summation on your views on Dr. Winfield's book or on Miss Jacoby or on Dr. Winfield even, or no?
Dr. Winfield's book, it seems to me, has as its primary value the fact that it points out and clarifies the immense complexity of the problem of China. The thing that I like particularly about Dr. Winfield's conclusions is the fact that in discussing the communists and some of the more demagogic programs that have been offered to give shortcuts to China's problems, he points out that two important things are necessary before any substantial progress is made in solving the agrarian problem. One is to increase the size of the Chinese farm. Second, to increase the production of the Chinese farm worker. Until those things are done, all these programs, which are useful in gaining power, but which are impractical once power is gained to solve China's problems, are useless and superfluous.
Thank you, Mr. Varney. And now for your minute statement, Mrs. Jacoby.
I agree. Dr. Winfield's book is excellent insofar as it discusses agriculture, biology. It has the best economic plan I have read. Those sections are excellent. It does, though, bother me when the political section begins. It doesn't explain to me why China could go communist or how China missed a chance to have a middle way. I do think, though, Dr. Winfield, your book holds the championship for having the most appalling statistic I've yet read. When you're talking about the roundworms, those awful intestinal parasites which are about as large as a lead pencil, you say that the intestines of Chinese people contain enough of those awful things to reach 50 times around the equator. I think that will ruin my sleep for months.
Now you've succeeded in doing something to mine, Mrs. Jacoby. And now, Dr. Winfield, would you sum up whatever you want to sum up?
Well, of course, it is perfectly true that the basic facts that I've been trying to deal with are the nexus in which communism has spread and is gaining power in China. And I'm not, while I'm an anti-communist, I'm not sure that everything that's happening in China today that the communists are bringing into China are going to be lost in the forward-moving processes of change which are going to take place right on through the rest of our lives, and out of which eventually China and the rest of us, if we keep hammering away at the job, are going to start shaping new forms of life for people in backward, overcrowded parts of the world. And one of the things that the communists may very well release into Chinese life, down at the grassroots, is some new degrees of cooperation among groups of people. And perhaps there's going to be something in the direction of that type of thing if the communists in China don't stick too close to the Moscow line. But I can't help but have my dreams disturbed by the fear that my friends who have learned genetics and know how to breed new plant seeds are going to have from Moscow the new doctrine of inheritance of acquired characteristics, which was disproved over 100 years ago, forced on them by way of a too close following of the Moscow line. And it's those sort of things that worry me about the situation.
Thank you.
But I believe that we're going to go on through anyway.
I hope that none of you acquire a characteristic of contentiousness from our program, which will be inherited by future generations. But thank you all, and time's up for the author and the critics, and here's your announcer to tell us what lies ahead.
Next week, we have two guest authors, both distinguished American ladies, the internationally known author of The Good Earth and other bestsellers, Pearl Buck, and Islanda Good Robeson, wife of Paul Robeson and author of African Journey. Be sure to be with us next week when American Argument, The book which Mrs. Buck and Mrs. Robeson have written together will be under fire. And now, back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Gerald F. Winfield for coming here today to discuss his book, China, the Land and the People. And to thank you, Mrs. Jacoby, and you, Mr. Varney, for joining us, this is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone and directed by Lee Jones. This is Arthur Gary speaking. It's Horace Hite tonight on NBC.